This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, I'm Denny Somach, and this is The Rock Podcast. As a rock historian, producer, and best-selling author, I've collected thousands of interviews over the years, and I try and bring you the greatest stories that we have here. On this episode, we're going to present my recent conversation with David Leaf. Now, he's an award-winning writer, director, and producer. Just some of the projects he's been involved with include The Night James Brown Saved Boston, The U.S. versus John Lennon, The Bee Gees, This Is Where I Came In, and the acclaimed all-star tribute to Brian Wilson, to name just a few. As an author, he's responsible for writing liner notes for the reissued albums by the Beach Boys. He's sort of a Beach Boys and actually Brian Wilson expert. And he did the box set for the Pet Sounds Sessions and the Smile Sessions. I can go on and on, but we're here to discuss the new edition of God Only Knows, the story of Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, and the California Myth. Now, before we get started, I thought I would go to my archives for a couple of bits from Mike Love and Brian Wilson, just to get you in the Beach Boys frame of mind. So first up is the story of the Beach Boys' first live performance, and then a word about Phil Spector, who had a tremendous influence on Brian Wilson, and these are just a couple of things that you'll hear David discuss. So first, Mike Love on the debut Beach Boys gig.
Our very first paid performance was later on that year on December 31st, 1961 at the Veterans Memorial Hall, or Coliseum, I guess they called it, which is no longer there, of course. It's been torn down in Long Beach, New Year's Eve, Long Beach. It was actually, as I look back on it, it was the Ritchie Valens Memorial show. And I don't know if the purpose of the show was to raise money for the family or simply to acknowledge Ritchie Valens, but it was quite an all-star review. And I remember Ike and Tina Turner, the Ikettes, that's what they were, doing I'm Blue, you know. So, it was great. We felt about as out of place as a white middle-class American family could be. In the middle of all these great black and R&B entertainers, we were the only white group on the stage with a little stand-up bass and a snare drum. You know, we just stood there like frightened little school kids, and we sang in front of this disbelieving audience. I don't know why we were there. I don't know how in the heck it happened. And then we got paid out of the box office as we were leaving, $50 apiece. And that was it.
And this is Brian Wilson about Phil Spector.
In music, you have, like anything else, like when Phil Spector produces a record, he takes one thing, a piano, and he blends it with one other thing, a guitar. And you work with these two things until they enhance each other, not sound like they're fighting each other or that The guitar sounds out of place. The piano sounds great, but the guitar sounds lousy. You know why? Because you're not bothering to go to the problem of getting just the right echo on that guitar, and just the right volume, and just the right sound on it. You know what I mean? The right texture of a sound. If a guy is strumming his guitar and it goes on, you know, in the speakers, hey, turn it down, play it a little softer, you know, or change the EQ on it. Make the high fidelity a little more high and the low fidelity just a little more low. Oh, there we go. Now it's starting to sound, you know, the same principle in creation, although it's much more complex than that. So I learned everything from it, except like Chuck Berry taught me how to play that guitar. You know, I don't play guitar myself, but he taught me how to help a guitar player.
Okay, now that we got you in the Beach Boys mode. So today, David Leaf is our guest. Hi, David. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Danny. It's good to see you. It's been a while.
Or should I call you Professor Leaf?
Only the students have to call me Professor. And when they do, I kind of look behind me to see who they're referring to.
Right. Okay.
But that's actually my classroom behind me.
Oh, okay. That's what sort of tipped me off. I thought, wait a minute, it's classroom. I wonder if he's, anyway. So we're here to talk about.
By the way, it's named Lonnie Hall.
Oh, it's the Herb Alpert School of Music, right?
Herb Alpert School of Music, and it should be actually Lonnie Hall Hall.
Right.
But
that's right.
It's a great place to teach.
So we're here today to talk about not a new book, but an updated book. And I want to make it clear to everybody, it's Brian Wilson, God Only Knows, The Beach Boys and the California Myth. This is not a Beach Boys book. This is a Brian Wilson book, correct?
Well, it certainly includes the Beach Boys to a great extent, but the focus is on Brian. In fact, the very first line of the book is, this is the story of Brian Wilson. So it should be clear to the reader that that's my focus. Obviously, the Beach Boys are a big part of it.
Right. So the original book you released in 1978, is that correct?
Correct, fall of 78.
And when did you start working on that one?
I started working on that actually in the fall of 77 through a long series of coincidences and circumstances. I got a contract to write it, and I had been obsessed with Brian and the Beach Boys since 71. So I had already done an enormous amount of research just by being a fan / fanatic.
Right.
Obsessed with the story. And so I knew what I wanted to say in general when I started, but it was when I got the book contract that kind of gave me the time and impetus to go interview everybody who I could find who would talk to me, who had been a part of Brian's life all the way back to his mother.
You know, and we'll talk a little bit about this after we talk about the book, but I would tell people, I mean, you've done so many different things and we'll go into it later, and you've nominated for awards and won awards and written TV specials and books and everything. Is it safe to say that you're the ultimate example of someone who took their fandom or love of fandom and made it a career?
I think Mark Lewisohn is probably the ultimate example of that, because Mark for over 40 years has been in the center of the Beatles world, doing incredible work. My fandom for Brian and the Beach Boys led me to the book, and that book was kind of the springboard to my career. But because of that book, I got a lot of other jobs. We'll put it that way. And each job led to the next one.
But you got to know Brian really well. You were actually at his wedding. I think you're a godfather to one of his daughters, right?
Right. I was an usher at his wedding along with Danny Hutton from Three Dog Night and Andy Paley. Carl Wilson was the best man. My late wife and I, godparents to Daria Wilson, Brian and Melinda's oldest of five. And I actually got to know him in a meaningful way during the writing of the book, because his girlfriend and her roommate invited me over to dinner when he was there, because they wanted me to get to know him a little bit outside of the public arena. I had met him a few times at Beach Boys events, but this was a chance to, you know, in private, not to interview him, just to be in his presence and hang out with him and get a sense of what kind of a person he was. And he was very quiet, very private, very, very shy. And clearly, you know, he has a great booming laugh. But at that time, when I first was getting to know him, it was a troubled time in his life, certainly.
And we can talk about that in a little while. Some of it I think you're referring to is the Dr. Landy era and some other things. But the difference between this and the original book, because you've added about 50% more, correct?
Oh, not quite 50, but actually the update is more than 50% of the length of the original book that came out in 78. There had been a short update for the 1985 edition. So this book is, I refer to it as a massive update, because so much has happened since the last edition came out in 1985. And I think even more to the point, I was involved in a lot of it. So the update of this book is kind of the opposite of the original book. The original book was written by a journalist, by somebody on kind of an Edward R. Murrow kind of mission to reveal the truth.
Right.
And this update is the story of my journey alongside Brian and what's happened in years since I became his friend. Because, you know, in today's world, you can go to Wikipedia and get the details and great information about pretty much anything that's happened, every album, every tour, every concert. So what could I offer the reader that they couldn't get anywhere else?
Right.
And what I realized was I had all these behind the scenes stories that nobody knew, that, you know, maybe me and a couple other people had experienced. And I felt in the telling of those stories, I could really add value to the original book.
So let's just start briefly and talk about the early days for a couple moments here. The Beach Boys came from Hawthorne, California, correct?
So the Wilson brothers grew up in Hawthorne. Brian was actually first lived in Inglewood. Mike Love lived in a nearby town. Al Jardine was from Hawthorne as well. So the band was formed when four of the five members were living in Hawthorne. At the time, Carl and Dennis were still in high school. I mean, they were just kids. Mike had graduated from high school. Brian and Al were going to junior college. So you know, it's interesting when we think about what the Beatles had to do before they got their contract with EMI, the 5 years between Paul and John meeting for the first time and them getting signed to EMI was really a lot of hard work. The Beach Boys, who were signed to an EMI subsidiary, Capitol, the same year the Beatles were signed, had been at it about 4 months, 5 months. I mean, it's really kind of stunning the difference in the story. They weren't working to become a successful rock group at all. One day, Dennis literally came home from a day surfing in the Pacific and said to Brian and Mike, hey, why don't you guys write a song about surfing? You could do it at the high school assembly. The kids would love it. And they did. It got recorded through a contact of the Wilson brothers, Father Murray, and it became a hit. Now, it was like winning the lottery. How often does that happen? And the answer is not very.
That was Surfing USA?
The first song was Surfing.
Just Surfing.
A really nondescript, kind of doo-wop-ish, very, very crude, as Murray Wilson called it, record. And there was nothing about that record that would make you think that the guy who co-wrote it was going to be the composer, arranger, and producer was going to change popular music. Nothing at all about that record would make you think that.
So you've really had a chance to go real deep, and I'm sure you've learned a lot more about them since the original book. Was there sibling rivalry when they were growing up?
The Wilson brothers, you know, were all so different. Dennis was out of the house. The father was abusive. The father also recognized Brian's musical talent and created musical opportunities for him, like turning the garage into a music room and buying Brian a reel-to-reel tape recorder when he was a teenager so he could practice a recording for freshman songs. So in that sense, Murray was good. But as an abusive father, it was tough sledding, and Brian, as the oldest brother, took the biggest brunt of it. Dennis, the middle brother, was like, I'm getting out of here. So he was off hanging out with friends, going to the beach, surfing. Carl, the youngest, you might say, was sort of hiding behind his mother's skirts. Hmm. But in terms of rivalry, I think they just looked up to Brian. They admired Brian. Brian was a high school sports star. He was tall, good looking, a lot of fun to be with. I mean, it's hard to picture when you think of Brian Wilson being the quarterback of the football team, being the center fielder of the Hawthorne High School baseball team. He wanted to be Mickey Mantle. Hmm. That was his ambition. But as he told me, he says, I couldn't hit the curve.
So what was their first gig? Do you know?
Their first gig was a New Year's Eve show, a local show, and they got paid, you know, maybe $100 to split amongst themselves. And it was, again, there was no plan on it becoming a career until the surfing became this local hit. And it actually, you know, dented the Billboard charts. And I think Murray Wilson recognized, because Murray was a wannabe in the music business. He had been unsuccessful in his attempts to be in the music business. And so he recognized, there's something here. Maybe we can make something happen. And so the Beach Boys recorded some song demos and shopped them. And the labels in LA turned them down until they got to Capitol, where a very young hip producer named Nick Vinay recognized that there was gold in them, their demos, and signed them. But they were just kids. Yeah. Just really kids when they signed with Capitol. I mean, what's, you know, people often ask me questions like, why did the Beatles do this and why did the Beach Boys do that? And one thing that came to me recently was that in 1962, Murray Wilson became the Beach Boys manager. And in 1962, Brian Epstein became the Beatles manager. So we had somebody who was a sophisticated man guiding the Beatles' fortune, somebody with connections in the music business, and you had Murray Wilson, who, you know, had a machine shop. So it was a very different, and of course there's the family relationship, which created all sorts of tension, and they ultimately had to fire Murray.
It's safe to say, though, that nobody had a bigger influence on the Beatles than Brian, right? And the Beach Boys.
The two biggest influence on the Beatles were Dylan and Brian's production and his composition and his vocal harmony arrangement. Dylan kind of gave people in pop music the license to say things meaningful in songs, that they weren't just about love. It wasn't just, I want to hold your hand and she loves you, but you could write a song, you know, like Norwegian Wood that had nothing to do with, I mean, it was about an affair, but it was, you know, very cleverly written. Brian's music, especially the Pet Sounds album and the Good Vibrations single, just stunned the Beatles. And so there was something of what was referred to as a production race. So Brian hears Rubber Soul and he says, I've got to do an album like that where everything sounds the same. He was talking about the American version of Rubber Soul. He comes out with Pet Sounds. And one of the most stunning things I ever heard, Sir George Martin said to me that Sergeant Pepper was the Beatles' attempt to equal Pet Sounds. He wasn't saying we equaled it or bested it. He was saying we were attempting to equal Pet Sounds. That's how influential Brian was on the Beatles at that particular time.
So where did Brian's knowledge of production and all that come from? I know he did work with Phil Spector. How much of an influence did Spector have?
So I think the two biggest influences, let's say the three biggest influences on Brian specifically were the Four Freshmen in terms of their harmonies. That's where the Beach Boys blend came from. Phil Spector in terms of production, from the point of view that Brian went to sessions that Phil was doing and saw the musicians that Phil was working with and hired them for Beach Boys sessions. And the third one is kind of obscure in the sense that how many people in rock and roll were influenced by George Gershwin. So the first piece of music Brian remembers hearing is Rhapsody in Blue, which is a pretty good theme song for a guy who ended up living, you know, the kind of roller coaster of an emotional life that he has. So you have him with this kind of, I won't say accidental death, but the kind of compositional genius of a Gershwin, the vocal harmony arrangement of the Freshmen, and the production technique of Spector. And I think those elements all come together and really start to, you know, they're there from the very beginning. If you listen to a song like In My Room, there's a melancholy quality to it, the warmth of the sun. But it was in 1965 where Brian truly began to find his own voice as what I call emotional songwriting. And he's writing songs like Please Let Me Wonder, and In the Back of My Mind, and The Little Girl I Once Knew. And he's really exploring relationships and what they mean. And that becomes that really flowers fully on Pet Sounds, which I think of as his emotional autobiography.
Now, I know I could sit here all day and talk to you about this, so I'm trying to hit certain points on this.
Sure.
I know that your quest to get Smile finished plays a big role here. Would you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, I had never heard the name Brian Wilson when I was younger. I had seen the Beach Boys in concert. I had gone to a few of their, I had bought a few of their singles. In 1971, there was an article in Rolling Stone written by Tom Nolan when the Surf's Up album came out. And I had never heard the name Brian Wilson before I read that article. I had never heard about Smile before I read that article. And when I read the article, I bought the Surf's Up album and I heard the song Surf's Up. And it was like, oh my God, they're not exaggerating. This Smile album was incredible. If this is one of the songs that was going to be on it. And I became obsessed, like a lot of people who were Brianistas, if you will, with what Smile was, what it could have been, what it might have been, what it would have done. And early on in this obsession, when I was in college, and talking to my roommate about all of this and not understanding what was going on in Brian's life, I literally said, I'm going to move to California, write a book about Brian Wilson, become his friend, and help him finish Smile. And if we want to talk about insane notions, that's, there have been some people who said, you know, one day I'm going to grow up to be president. But the odds of it happening are pretty slim. I doubt when Einstein was 19, he said, I'm going to come up with a theory of relativity. You know, it really was an insane notion. But I did move to California and I did write a book about Brian and I did become his friend. And in certain ways, I did help him finish Smile.
So tell me about that, because you wrote the liner notes for the box set, correct?
Right. So in 1993, when Capitol was starting to put the Beatles, the Beatles and the Beach Boys albums out on CD. In 1990, I was hired to write the liner notes for the entire Beach Boys catalog on Capitol. I think there were 20 albums. And then in 92, I wrote the essays for the Capitol 50th anniversary book on the Beatles and the Beach Boys, getting me access to the files. And in 93, I was hired with Andy Paley and Mark Lynette to produce a box set called Good Vibration, 30 Years of the Beach Boys. And it's not really difficult to go through the Beach Boys catalog and find four CDs worth of great material for a box set. The challenge was to tell a story, at least as I saw it. And so I sat down with Brian with the track listing and went over it with him. And I said, you know, between the single Good Vibrations and the single Heroes and Villains, there's this giant gap called Smile. And he kind of looked at me and I said, I'm not asking you to finish Smile, but I feel like we need to include some of the recordings from the Smile sessions here so your story is complete in this box set. And Brian is a really smart guy. He's a reasonable person. If you treat him like an artist whose work you're compiling, he responds with reason. And he said, okay, what songs do you think we should include? And I had a list in mind. I purposely didn't include the fire music because that had been one of the things that happened legendarily during the Smile sessions that had, you know, helped push him to stopping work on the record. Anyway, we ended up with a half hour of Smile music on that box set that had never been released before. The box set was a gigantic success. It went gold. And I felt like, okay, mission accomplished. I had helped get some Smile music out into the world. I had no idea what was to come. And in 2003, by which time I had, you know, been working, making music documentaries for a solid decade.
Right.
Brian had announced that he was not going to finish Smile, but he was going to create a version of Smile called Brian Wilson Presents Smile as a live concert. And one sunny afternoon in the summer of 2003, we were walking back from the movies, and he said, I really want you to be there when I'm doing this. I can't do it if you're not. And I said, well, Brian, I can't just take, you know, 6 months off from work to be there. I said, the only way I could be there every day is if we were making a documentary about this. And he said, okay, let's, you know, come on over to the house. We'll talk to Melinda about it. And I went over and talked to them about it. And we reached an agreement to that I was going to make this documentary. Of course, the next step is finding the financing for the documentary. And fortunately, a good friend of mine, Richard Walter, knew somebody at Showtime, and we went in and pitched it, and they said yes. So I suddenly found myself in a small room in Brian's house as he and the band began to gather to rehearse for this Brian Wilson Presents Smile. And it was kind of a stunning experience to be part of, let alone documenting.
Now, what was the name of that documentary? Because there's several of them out.
The documentary is called Beautiful Dreamer, Brian Wilson and the Story of Smile. And it concludes with the world premiere of Brian Wilson Presents Smile at Royal Festival Hall in London in February of 2004.
And you were there for that.
I was there for that. I was there for that. I would have been there if I was just a fan. I would have been there.
Okay. So as fans, let's get right to the what was the backstage like there? Who showed up for that concert?
A lot of people showed up for it. I get kind of goosebumps thinking about it. But I would say the three most famous people I can think of off the top of my head who were there were Paul McCartney, George Martin, and Jeff Beck. Sir Paul and Sir George didn't come opening night. They came, I think, the fourth night of Brian did a world premiere week a residency there. And they came, and at intermission, Sir Paul came backstage to encourage Brian, like, you know, you can do this. And you see that in the documentary, they have one of the most, Brian and Paul have a relationship unlike, I think, any relationship Paul had in his life other than the relationship with John, in that Paul regards Brian as a peer musically, but he also knows the damage that Brian has suffered at the hands of others, as well as self, as well as his own drug abuse. He knows the struggles he's been through. So Paul is like a cheerleader for Brian, like, you can do this. And Brian actually is an extraordinarily confident artist. And it's like, in his head, he says, I know I got this. And but you if you watch that conversation between he and Paul in the movie, you know, Paul is encouraging him, and Brian's almost like, you know, he kisses his hand. And it's almost like, okay, just let me be. It's intermission. I want to get ready for the for the show. Nobody ever ends a conversation with Paul McCartney. Right. Everybody who gets to be in Paul's presence always has something else they want to say. Brian is the only one I've ever seen do that. I mean, another time we were at the House of Blues for a listening party, and after talking to Paul, he was like, okay, I got to go get dinner now. And we leave. I mean, it's just, you know, and it's people like, he's leaving, you know, he's kind of unique. Doesn't even begin to describe him. Everyone's unique. Brian's really special.
And Paul's favorite song is God Only Knows.
Right. When in 1990, I had the honor of being the one who interviewed Paul for the liner notes for the Pet Sounds CD. And I think it was a really special interview for him, because since the Beatles had hit, every interview he did was about the Beatles. How long is it going to last? You know, et cetera. When the Beatles broke up, every interview was like, when are you guys going to get back together? This interview wasn't about the Beatles. This interview was about what Paul thought about somebody else's record. So for a half hour, we were talking about what Brian Wilson meant to him. And in the course of that conversation, he talked about Pet Sounds probably being not only his favorite album, but God Only Knows being what he thinks maybe the greatest song ever. And when I was putting together this updated edition of the book, I was able to get an email to Sir Paul, and he wrote back the quote that opens the book, in which he talks about God Only Knows and the genius of Brian Wilson. And, you know, I don't know a better way to open a book than a quote in which Paul McCartney is talking about the song, which is kind of the title song for the book. So that Paul is an extraordinarily generous artist in many, many ways. When it comes to Brian, he's off the charts kind.
So did you have anything to do with the BBC God Only Knows video that came out several years ago?
I only wish I did. The BBC God Only Knows video, people should Google that and watch that.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to go check this out if you haven't seen it, although I think it's got millions and millions of views.
It's quite amazing. Stevie Wonder, Brian May, you know, just Elton John, Brian Wilson, and then a whole host of multi-generational artists, each singing a little bit of God Only Knows. And the end of it is kind of hilarious with Brian at the piano and a surprise visitor to the piano. But it's a great, great video. Great video.
So history-wise, because we were talking about the documentary, there have been several documentaries on both Brian and the Beach Boys. And I think there was that made-for-TV movie on the Beach Boys. Could you give us your rating of some of these things? Because I've read various, like, they didn't like the TV movie, or, you know, give us the real deal here.
I think that the best projects to look for are the ones that Alan Boyd did. Alan Boyd has worked on Beach Boys projects for decades. He has been incredibly passionate about the music and the group and Brian forever. The first Beach Boys documentary to talk about, I think it's called The Beach Boys, an American Band, done by Malcolm Leo, which is kind of the Beach Boys' greatest hits in terms of performances of theirs from the 60s and 70s. And so that's a good starting off point. I'll be immodest, and I will mention a show called An All-Star Tribute to Brian Wilson, which I wrote and produced with Phil Ramone and Chip Racklin. It took place in 2001 at Radio City Music Hall. And among the artists who were on the show were Elton John, Paul Simon, Billy Joel, David Crosby, Carly Simon, Jimmy Webb, Vince Gill, Wilson Phillips reunited for the program. Sir George Martin came out and presented a package. Dennis Hopper was there to introduce Brian Wilson. Chaz Palminteri was the host of the show. And New York is probably the city in America where Brian's most popular, in the way that London is the city in the world where he's most popular. So doing it in my hometown was really exciting. And, you know, Brian did a duet of Wouldn't It Be Nice with Elton John. But what's significant to the Smile story about that show is we opened that program with the Boys Choir of Harlem doing Our Prayer from Smile. Vince Gill, David Crosby, and Jimmy Webb did Surf's Up. Ann and Nancy Wilson of Heart did Good Vibrations. And Brian himself, for the first time ever, did Heroes and Villains Live. And after that, those songs started to become part of his live act, his live touring set list. And that's really what led to his being ready, willing, and able to conquer the challenge of presenting Smile. Go ahead.
You know, I was just going to finish what you're going to say, because my next...
Well, I was going to tell this, the story of how Heroes and Villains became part of the show is kind of... It goes to the random nature of life. I think of my whole story with Brian Wilson like one of those giant domino displays where people set up and they hit one domino and thousands of dominoes topple. We were at a Christmas party at a band member's house in the fall, in December of 2000, Scott Bennett's house. And Brian and my late wife were sitting on the piano bench with their back to the piano. And Brian said to Eva, "What do you want for Christmas?" And she said, "I want you to play Heroes and Villains." And he said, "Okay." And he turned around and played Heroes and Villains. And I'm not exaggerating. Everyone in the house came running into that room because they not only recognized the song, but they recognized Brian's piano playing, which is a distinctive style. And everybody in the band, they were Smile fanatics too. But as Darian Sahanaja, the musical leader, would say, you couldn't even mention Smile to Brian. You couldn't even bring it up to talk to him about it. And then all of a sudden, there he is playing Heroes and Villains. And as soon as he finishes playing it, Eva says to him, "says, well, you've got to do that at the tribute." And he goes, "Okay." I mean, it was just, you know, it's like, "Oh, you think this is good?" And what happened to the tribute that was important, he had been told that this music was, in his words, inappropriate, that this was not good for the Beach Boys' career, and he had shelved it. Mm. And now he was in front of 3,000 people at Radio City Music Hall playing Smile music and getting a standing ovation for it. And that really changed. He couldn't deny what he was seeing, because all along, people like me are telling, "Oh, people, Brian, people want to hear Smile. They love that music." Yeah. But he couldn't deny what he saw.
Now, the most recent thing on Brian, is it Love and Mercy?
Well, Love and Mercy was a feature film that came out about 7 or 8 years ago, which had, you know, Paul Dano and John Cusack play Brian at different parts of Brian's life. And then there was a documentary called Long Promised Road, which aired on American Masters on PBS recently. Mm-hmm. And each of those has a lot to recommend. I mean, Paul Dano, his performance as Brian during the Pet Sounds and Smile era is really terrific. Love and Mercy has a lot of great moments in it, for sure. The only beef I have with Love and Mercy, as if I were a film critic, is I feel like it dismissed, it made Murray a bad guy without also acknowledging the fact that the Wilson home was filled with music. So I felt like we needed to see a little of that. It also kind of made Van Dyke Parks look like a hippie clown, as opposed to this brilliant, brilliant lyricist and collaborator on Smile. We only see one scene with Van Dyke, and it's not a positive scene. But I think Love and Mercy is great. I recommend it highly.
And you think that Love and Mercy is his signature song too, right?
Love and Mercy is most definitely Brian's signature song, Denny. He wrote it for his first solo album in 1988. And when he started touring, after a while, it became the encore. And I think it's important, if we think about going to a Beach Boys show, and Beach Boys concerts are great fun, and everybody's singing along, and they usually end with the song Fun, Fun, Fun. Brian's shows for, I don't know, 20 plus years ended with the song Love and Mercy. That's really a moving moment. He sings Love and Mercy is what you need tonight, Love and Mercy tonight. And I feel like he's not just saying it to the audience, but he's saying it to himself. Mm. That Love and Mercy is what he needed in his life. Because it was written during a time when he was under the complete control of a mad doctor, who, as Brian refers to those 9 years, it was like being in prison. So Love and Mercy is a very important song. Back to your documentary question, I think the best documentary to watch is kind of a starter documentary in the Brian Wilson world. Is a film called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, but directed by Don Was. You can see it on YouTube, and it's not very long. It's maybe 70 minutes or so. And I love it for a lot of reasons, but not the least of which, there's a lot of truth in it. Mm-hmm. There's also the truth of just the music. And there's Brian and his brother Carl with their mother Audrey singing a version of In My Room. It's like, oh my God. This is what it was like in the Wilson home when these kids were growing up and the families would sing together. There's great interviews with Brian in there, and as well as with others like Tom Petty and Lindsey Buckingham and Linda Ronstadt, as well as Brian's first wife, Marilyn Wilson. Really, it's very stylized, it's very stark, and it's very strong.
So what's the general feeling about that made-for-TV movie, which is probably the thing that most people have seen because it was on TV?
The made-for-TV movie, it's what most made-for-TV movies are. It's melodramatic. The challenge with telling anybody's story in a movie is how do you compress 40, 50 years into 2 or 4 hours? And how do you tell all sides of the story? You know, what's the point of view? Because nobody agrees on what happens. I mean, on what happened. I mean, one of the things, you know, that I talk about in this new version of the book, I have an extensive author's note where I look back on the original book because I didn't really want to rewrite the original book. Mm. So many people had wanted to read it. I felt I should essentially leave it alone so that in this book, you're getting kind of two books for the price of one. You're getting the old book and then all this new material. In a movie, whose story are you telling? Well, they're telling the story of the Beach Boys. Well, the Beach Boys themselves don't agree on their story. So how's a movie going to be something that everybody agrees on? And so I've learned that there isn't one side to the story or two sides to the story or five or even 10. There's just a lot of sides to this story. And I ultimately came to the conclusion, which is a funny thing to say, as I'm asking your listeners and viewers to buy this book, is that the place to find Brian Wilson's story is in his music. That's where I think he reveals himself the most.
So Brian just celebrated his 80th birthday. What's his health like these days?
He's 80 years old. He's had this unbelievably difficult life in the last 30 years. You know, fortunately, when he and Melinda started seeing each other again after the Landy regime ended, I remember what he said about 95, 96. You know, why are you so active now? And he said, I have emotional security. And I think that's the answer to your question, that Brian has been able to do what he has done because he has emotional security. He has the infirmities of any 80-year-old. And he also has the issues of, you know, someone who's taken a lot of prescription drugs all these years with what they ultimately do to you. And, you know, he with his brother Dennis and as well as with some of the wilder LA friends of your, like Harry Nilsson, there was a lot of cocaine snorted. So, you know, what's the cumulative impact of that? I'm not a doctor. But Brian was nice, you know, very nicely for my 70th birthday, he and his four of his five kids took me out to dinner to celebrate. And we had a memorable night. I think Brian may be, you know, reaching a different place in his career where he will, you know, not tour again. Don't know. I'm not psychic. I don't have a crystal ball, but I don't think he loves going on the road. He loves touring. He wants to tour. He loves being with his musicians who are like his musicians are his favorite people.
Right.
They're the ones who bring his music to life. So he loves being with them. He loves them bringing his music to life every night. He loves the reaction of the audience. Curiously, he doesn't show it. I don't know what's to come. I just know that what's happened in the past 35 years or so since I wrote the original edition of the book was an absolute renaissance of him as a solo artist, a career that I don't think any of us expected, anticipated, even dreamed of. I mean, there's, you know, 15 or so albums, movies, documentaries, tours, historic tours. He toured Pet Sound several times. He toured Smile. He wrote an entire new piece called That Lucky Old Son. He did an album of Gershwin songs. He did an album of Disney songs. He's done other solo records. I mean, he really came out of hiding, if you will, and he was ready to share his heart and soul with us. And if he's ready to stop doing that, then okay, he has more than given us anything we had a right to expect and ever dreamed of.
So it's now the 60th anniversary of the Beach Boys. Is he going to be doing anything in connection with that? And if not, what do you know of any plans of what the Beach Boys are going to be doing?
I don't know of any plans. I had heard there was a documentary being made, and I heard recently that the work had stopped on it. So I don't have any inside information on the Beach Boys whatsoever. The last time I worked on an official Beach Boys project, I think was the Pet Sound Sessions back in 96, 97, mm-hmm. Which caused a lot of trouble, not trouble for the world, trouble for me and my relationship with the group as a whole, because I think there was a feeling that I had given Brian too much praise and too much credit. I'm what they call a Brianista.
All right. Well, thanks you again, Professor Leaf. And good luck with the book. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. It's great to see you and great to talk to you.
That's our conversation with David Leaf on this edition of the Rock Podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening, and a reminder that you can pick up a copy of the new edition of God Only Knows, the story of Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, and the California Myth. It's available at Amazon and other places. And you can get a unique VIP experience at David's website, leafprod.com. And we'll put a link on our site as well. So thanks for listening. Tell your friends about this podcast. And you can find us on the website, therockpodcast.com, and on Facebook. You can also send your comments and let me know your thoughts. Contact me at hello@therockpodcast.com. So for now, goodbye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.